Ahoy.
Hello.
And welcome to Policy Voices by Friends of Europe, an independent think tank with a difference. Each week from Brussels, we bring you powerful conversations with policy voices from around the world. Policy voices talking policy choices.
That you are in a breakout room, and in that breakout room is a goat herder from Socotra off the coast of Yemen. And also in that group, there's a 19-year-old student from Wuhan, an elderly seamstress from Brazil, a yoga teacher from Italy, and a farmer from Congo, a young, lovely young farmer from Congo called Guillaume.
Hello and welcome to Policy Voices, Friends of Europe's weekly podcast on European and global affairs. I'm your host, Caterina Villanova. What you just heard at the beginning of today's episode is what the first Citizens Global Assembly looked like. It took place around COP26 in Glasgow, and it provided a true snapshot of what humanity looks like. The first Global Citizens Assembly, co-initiated by Jamie Kelsey, was kickstarted because of climate change, but its potential goes beyond a single issue. By bringing people together from truly diverse backgrounds, it can be a solution to the polarized world we live in today. That's why I spoke to Jamie Kelsey from the Citizens Global Assembly for the third and last episode of this series on the rise of the far right in Europe. So stay on that side to listen to our conversation. Good morning, Jamie, and welcome to Policy Voices. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on a Monday morning about the Global Citizens Assembly. So how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing very well. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you. So maybe let's start with a more broad question. Why a Global Citizens Assembly? What is a Global Citizens Assembly trying to do that you don't see that governments are doing?
I come from an activist background, and I've spent three decades shouting at buildings, particularly around climate. So I've been to several COP conferences, and I was outside the notorious Copenhagen COP conference in 2009. And this is where we realized nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen that's consummate with the catastrophe that we're facing. And I came to the conclusion that you're not going to deal with the climate crisis until you deal with the crisis in democracy. And in those buildings, the United Nations has grown from an admirable set of values, but their hands are tied. Their hands are tied by the tyranny of the vote, the veto. So the superpowers at the end of the Second World War, when the United Nations was set up, they ensured that they had this special power, which is the power of the veto. And that means that when we're confronted with very significant crises, one country can stop all the rest of the world acting. And we're seeing that played out continually. But this is particularly a problem with climate. Jean-Claude Juncker said a really interesting quote, which is, "We all know what to do, but we don't know how to do it and get re-elected." And I think that's really fundamental. All those leaders in the United Nations, they all know that climate is a complete crisis, and it's terrifying. But how to operate in a way where the changes that are desperately needed, how those changes can be made within institutions like the United Nations, where there are such profound constrictions, this is a significant problem. And now you look at Ireland, and for a lot of people, citizens assemblies, Ireland is a country that they'll learn about very quickly. And in Ireland, if you were a politician and you had an opinion about abortion, it doesn't matter what your opinion was, but you just lost the election because half of your electorate would hate you, whatever your opinion was. Here is an example where decisions that are too hard for politicians to make were made by a citizens' assembly instead. And by that same logic, it seemed obvious that we need to initiate a program of a global citizens' assembly where you have the human family itself making those difficult decisions that our world leaders just cannot make. So that's why a global assembly. And we came together in 2020, actually. We started working together, myself and two well-known practitioners, Richard Wilson and Claire Mellier, from an organization called ISWE, I-S-W-E. And we started to form the plans around a global assembly. Then we began to build the team, and we ran the world's first global citizens assembly in 2021. And it was a prototyping year, and we wanted to prove what's possible. And we did it for $100 million, and it nearly killed us. But we ended up presenting five times at the famous Glasgow Climate Conference. And we were showing that this can be done. And I think what's fundamental is it had a very high level of independence. We were independent of all the funders. The few funders that we had, they had to sign an agreement saying they had no impact on the process. We were independent of NGOs. We were independent of governments. And we wanted to show what's possible. And it made history, although not many people know about it yet. But the fact is that the next Global Assembly will be informed because of what we did in 2021. And the last point is the positive note. Just don't underestimate how extraordinary this species is. We are capable of extraordinary things.
So you answered the why, and it's very clearly, why do we, as a species, to use your words, why do we need a global citizens assembly? So my next question would be, what are global assemblies? Perhaps it's easier to speak of an example. You already started talking about the global citizens assembly that took place around the COP26 in Glasgow. So maybe you can use that as an example of how can a global assembly be organized? What does it look like in practice?
There's only been this one. There's never been one before, right? So we only have one example to draw on. So what it looked like in practice was sitting on the edge of your seat for an algorithm, okay? So the algorithm was a mixture of random longitude and latitude and population density. So then when we pressed go on the button, we watched all these points land on the world map. But because it was mixed with population density, that meant that 18 landed in China and 17 landed in India and 14 landed in Africa. 3 landed in Brazil. 1 landed in Coventry in England. 1 landed on an island off Yemen. And then our job and the team that worked on this were incredibly dedicated. It was an enormous mountain of work to do all this. And it was a tiny team. And I will forever be in awe of the work that they did, because their next step was they had to contact a community group within, I think it was 100 kilometers of each point. So they had to contact a community group, onboard them to the project, pay them. And then the first job of that community group was they had to go and find 6 strangers. So it can't be anyone you know on Facebook, or can't be a relative or a colleague or someone you went to school with. These community groups were going out into the streets, talking, knocking on doors, right? And we've got lots of pictures of them doing that. It's quite amazing, right? And so each community group found 6 people. Then you have algorithm number 2. So that's 600 people. And then we pressed the button for algorithm number 2. And algorithm number 2 boiled it down to 100 people. And that was representative based around age, gender, economic background, education, views on climate. And so you ended up with a genuine snapshot of the human family. So what that looked like was 10% have no formal education. So 10% of them had never seen a computer. 70% are living on $10 or less a day. 50% are women. 13% are white. You know, it was us. It was the human family. So then you have breakout groups. And for your listeners, I think it's always fascinating to actually know what it looked like. So this was during COVID. So it was online. And you had an army of translators and note takers and facilitators. But just look at this, that you are in a breakout room, and in that breakout room is a goat herder from Socotra off the coast of Yemen. And also in that group, there's a 19-year-old student from Wuhan, an elderly seamstress from Brazil, a yoga teacher from Italy, and a farmer from Congo, a young, lovely young farmer from Congo called Guillaume. That was repeated 10 times, no, about 15 times. We had about 15 breakout groups. It was us. It was the human family. It was amazing to behold. And they met for 68 hours over 11 weeks And they had, again, we experimented, but the people behind this are pioneers, world leaders, basically. And so there was a lot of innovations. So for the first time, the learning aspect of it, it included members of the fossil fuel industry. So we had leaders of the oil industry from Nigeria, but we also had indigenous, what's called indigenous wisdom keepers or elders, or basically people who hold the kind of wisdom that is pre-colonial. So we included a very round experience of learning for the assembly members.
I want to go back for a second to the topic of representation. You explained very clearly how you ensure that representation was ensured in the Global Assembly. You know, this very visual image of the pins dropping in Yemen, in China, in Brazil, etc. So if we're talking about a Global Assembly, it goes without question. And of course, you need to have representation of economic backgrounds, of gender, of geographical locations. However, for me, what was interesting is that you also involved someone who was coming from the oil industry in Nigeria specifically. And perhaps this could be contradictory. So you're trying to solve climate change, easy peasy. And why would you invite someone that would be completely against, in theory, with what you're doing, what you're trying to achieve?
Yeah, that's a really good, important question. So the people from the oil industry, they were part of the learning experience. They weren't assembly members, right? They're part of the learning experience, right? So they were very important because obviously the process of learning in the Global Assembly was, this is what climate change is. You know, so you've got to bear in mind, a lot of the people in the assembly went, oh, I thought it was God. I thought it was our sins and wrongdoings. And now I know that it's actually this science called climate science. They didn't know about that. And so everyone was learning about climate change and how bad it is and how it's going to get much worse. But then obviously the conversation has to be, well, what are we going to do about it? So then you get into the conversation about transitioning away from fossil fuels. That's why people from the oil industry in Nigeria were fundamental, because they're able to say, look, we're not stupid. We know that climate change has been caused by burning fossil fuels, but you can't turn around to us and say, stop drilling oil. That's the end of our economy. So you're punishing us. So they were vital for that conversation about what just transition can look like. Okay, so that was a really important thing. So they were not denying climate change at all. They were there as expert voices on what a just transition needs to consider, which is, you know, countries, poor countries like Nigeria, that are, their only industry is oil. Their only significant industry is oil. If you're going to stop burning fossil fuels, then you have to look after Nigeria. So it was really helpful to have them there, you know.
So Glasgow happened, the first Global Citizens Assembly took place. You met for 60 hours, you told me. And so what happened in the end? What did you do with all those ideas, all this brainstorming, all these hours? What happened in the end? But for the outcomes, policy proposals?
Yeah. So it ended up as a people's declaration. So the deliberation period of the Global Assembly then arrived at a people's declaration. And anyone listening to this can find it all on globalassembly.org. And those recommendations were presented or offered to the Glasgow COP. And we had a small team who went up to Glasgow. So some of our sort of experts who organized the process. So that was Claire and Rich from ISWE, Eva Sawain from I4 Policy, and an amazing advocate. And she was 20, I think she was just 21, called Susan Nakyung Lee, who's a young South Korean woman. She was our main spokesperson. She came from an organization in Spain, I think called Deliberata. Anyway, we were able to tell the congregations there in different meetings about, look, this has happened. This is what happens when you listen to the people rather than the leaders who are very compromised. We recognize leaders are compromised. So this is what happens when you hear from people who aren't compromised. These are people who are living on the front line of climate. So we were able to bring that story into the conversation. But this was a prototyping year. We recognize that it will not have any power, and it won't have any power until we generate a social mandate, a global social mandate. In other words, the work for me, particularly now, the work is to develop ways by which people learn this story through popular culture. This cannot arrive in your life through an intelligent article in a middle-class newspaper. It should arrive in your life through hip-hop, through the narrative in a popular soap opera, through a film. I'm making a film about this. So we were able to actually bring the story into COP, but we knew that the world leaders wouldn't go, okay, we'll do everything that it says. But we were starting an idea, you know, and as Victor Hugo said, nothing can stop an idea whose time has come. And this is definitely an idea whose time has come. So that was the end of that first prototyping year. And as I've mentioned earlier, we now have these two organizations, ISWE and GLOCAN, and they are both working towards establishing a permanent, independent global assembly structure. And we recognize that over the next years, it's going to become frighteningly real. Climate collapse is going to be frighteningly real. And therefore, by positioning this new independent permanent global assembly structure, we think it's increasingly likely that world leaders will look to our structure to provide the decisions that they're too frightened to make. That's where the work is now.
You used a very crucial word, the word power, and that was my next question. So where does the power lie in the Global Citizens Assembly? Because it's undeniably inspiring. You managed to, you know, this snapshot that you created, you know, from a farmer, from the yoga teacher, from these people from these completely different backgrounds across the world. It is incredibly inspiring. There is a lot of potential there. But my question is, how do you take it a step further? So you met, you created these policy proposals, these recommendations, you show them to politicians and be like, hey, okay, we talked, we discussed, and we came up with this. But how can you force them to, maybe perhaps force is too much of a strong word, but how can you make sure that they act on them? They don't simply, you know, give you a pat on the back and say, great job, now let the adults do the work almost. I don't want to sound too patronizing, but I think you get what I'm getting at here.
Absolutely. Well, that last image that you just described, you know, like pat on the head going, well done, now let the adults get on with it. I think that's what's happened with citizens' assemblies so far. So where the power lies, and so power, I think with much of the deliberative democracy world, there's a real naivety about power. You know, we need a lot more work in the area of power literacy. How power works and how power changes. And I think a lot of the deliberative democracy world is just, yeah, like I say, it's naive about it in the sense that they imagine if we just develop the right process, then the world leaders will follow. It's just not going to work like that. The fundamental elements here are threefold. So first of all, like I said, we are entering a time of catastrophic environmental ecological collapse. So business as usual is going to go out the window. And we believe that this process that we've created and this the permanent independent one that we're advocating for, we believe that in times of complete collapse, it's much more likely that power holders will look to this as a solution to make the decisions they're frightened to make. So there's that, number one. Number two is what I mentioned earlier, social mandate. So at the moment, very few people know about these. So I started, when we did the Global Assembly, I started something called the Cultural Wave. And what that basically means is using popular culture to bring this story into people's lives. Now, if you reach enough people globally, if you reach enough people so that people are generally, in my experience, when people know about these models, they go, why aren't we doing this already? This is common sense, right? So when you reach enough people so that hundreds of millions, if not billions of people around the world are going, look, we need this. We understand it. We feel it. We see us in it, because it's basically us being the decision makers, right? People will start to kind of say, this is what we want. So you have this social mandate. Now, when politicians recognize the fact that a very high number of their electorate are going, we want a global assembly, then they'll go, well, okay, well, now it's okay for me to go for it because they're on my side. And then the third point is you are going to need a movement, all right? So that movement's out there. All the elements are out there, but they haven't come together yet. And so what I know that ISWE and GLOCAN are building is a coalition of businesses, civic institution leaders, NGOs, and ideally world leaders, presidents and prime ministers, building a coalition of people signing up to this, saying we will welcome a global, independent, global, permanent citizens assembly. We will welcome it. All right. So that's part of the movement, is the coalition. But of course, the other part of the movement is movements can be, you know, like I was part of Extinction Rebellion. So that's like lots of people in the street shutting down cities, using civil disobedience. But there are other ways of movements. And I think culture is the key here. I think it's really important that people recognize that great change has happened in the past through culture. In my country, during apartheid in South Africa, there was a great number one hit called Free Nelson Mandela. Don't underestimate what a profound impact that had on the consciousness of young people in this country, and it shifted things. And so I guess the third point is we need to mobilize a cultural interventionist global movement. And that's really where my work is. My organization is oneworldornone.world. And it's dedicated to working with popular culture so that more and more people become involved in this movement. Those are the three areas that will then make it easier for power to shift. Otherwise, people are just being naive, as if Saudi Arabia are going to go, you know, you're right, we're going to stop drilling. You know, this has to belong to the people. It has to belong to the human family itself. And we need to kind of grow up in terms of how we understand governance and power. We need to grow up and we need to move from an adult to child relationship to an adult to adult relationship. We need to reimagine what democracy can be. So it's down to everyone listening to this. Okay. It's not like you've got leaders or a bloke, usually a bloke who's written a book. It's actually down to us, okay, to build this consciousness that we can do better than this. That's what's fundamental. It's an extraordinary species. We're capable of extraordinary things. It's down to us to shift how power works in the future.
There is a reason why in autocracies, artists and cultural in general are usually the first ones, the first targets of autocratic governments. And that's just ringing from what you were saying. And I was just looking across the globe and I was like, yep, check, check, check. We've talked at length and so far about climate change because, of course, the Global Citizens Assembly had its peak moment at the COP26 in Glasgow. But this is the third installment of a podcast series on the rise of the far right. So perhaps who's listening to us is thinking, what did I sign up for? I signed up for something different. So I want to ask you now, how can the Global Citizens Assembly help diffuse the right of the far right? So we have this prototype of our Global Citizens Assembly work, and so far it works to tackle climate change. But how does it work with a different topic? And is it a matter of, okay, we just have this baseline of how it works and we just tackle a different topic?
Okay, so for those people who have been listening so far going, what's this got to do with the rise of the far right? It's actually got everything to do with it, because there are other podcasts out there which is complaining about the rise of the far left. And we have to start to understand that the work that's modeled by citizens' assemblies is listening. I'm not going to make any excuses for people who are racists. I'm not going to make any excuses for people who have far right views at all. But there's a really fundamental problem here, which is we are so polarized. The moment someone is speaking from the far right, everyone's going to go, well, you know, you'll shut up. But then the same from the far right, they go, shut up, you lefty libtards. You know, it's just like, that's got to go. As long as that polarization remains, we're looking at an horrific future. And these assemblies are anti-polarization machines, without a doubt. And I think this is one of the lesser known aspects of citizens' assemblies or citizens' juries. Because the fact is that people with very opposing views sit and listen for long periods of time. And don't underestimate what happens when that process is engaged in and facilitated well. So, for example, a story that is used too much, but it's a good example, is the same-sex marriage assembly in Ireland, where a man was chosen by sortition. So by democratic lottery, and he came up from Southern Ireland, from Cork, and he was a retired postmaster, but he was a raging homophobe. And this assembly was about same-sex marriage, right? And he kept sitting at the same table by chance. He kept being sat next to a 22-year-old, a very gay, very camp 22-year-old man, right? And so at the beginning, I think it was 10 weekends or something. So at the beginning, the old homophobe wanted to kill this young man. But 10 weekends later, he has his arm around the young man. I would die for this kid. This kid is the grandson I never had. And then he describes, I don't want to trigger your audience. So the old man describes an horrific experience that happened to him when he was very young. And because of this experience, I've spent my whole life in fury and pain and anger and hurt. And this young man has allowed me to be free. This young man has helped me speak for the first time about what's happened to me. And I'm free, and I would die for this kid. So that's a graphic example of what happens very often in assemblies. So now to come back to this idea of the rise of the far right, we need to listen. We can't just continually polarize ourselves. We need to sit and listen for as long as it takes to understand how people have arrived at the views that they've got. Otherwise, we don't deserve to have this evolution in democracy. It has to be based on non-judgment. And it's hard. You're talking about refugees sitting with extreme racists, but all the evidence from these assemblies shows that when you have these situations and people listen in a well-facilitated conversation, they don't necessarily end up agreeing, but they end up having respect and a deepening level of trust. Our similarities are far greater than our differences. And this emerges the whole time in these processes. Fascism, the rise of the far right, is testimony to the fact that we are so profoundly polarized. And we can spend all our lives going on marches, shouting anti-fascist slogans, or we have to sit down. We all have to listen to each other. It's fundamental, okay? And if we don't do that, like I say, we don't deserve this. These new evolutions in democracy. And that's the key. What you'll find with the far right is they've made all these assumptions. And often with the far left, they've made all these assumptions. Now, we can stay in these totally divided houses, or we come together, and assemblies provide the ability to come together.
Now, I was drawing this parallel between this oil executive from Nigeria and how important it was to have them in the conversation about climate change. And it seems like when it comes to the far right and when it comes to people who are extremely homophobic, people who are extremely intolerant towards refugees and migrants, who are completely against bodily autonomy for you know, whoever, it seems that it's even more important than to bring them in the conversation, because otherwise we're just talking amongst ourselves. But I can't stop but feeling that at the source of all of this, it's misinformation. It's it's because something happened to this one person, then they just grow and they live their entire lives with this misconception, this misinformation. So how can the Global Citizens Assembly, or Citizens Assembly in general, also help in playing a role against the misinformation, and especially when we're just living our lives? I mean, I'm speaking to you over Zoom. Huh? I'm in Brussels. You are in the UK, I believe. And, you know, so we're talking on Zoom. We do our work via email. We live on social media. How can Citizens Assembly help bridging these gaps?
This is also a really important question. I'm really grateful you're asking it, because these two areas of assemblies, not many people know much about. So what I've just been discussing is these assemblies, when they're well facilitated, they are anti-polarization machines. Okay. They will stop fascism in its tracks. I've got no doubt about that, right? But now your second question is also something that not enough people know about this. So misinformation travels 4 times more quickly and reaches 6 times more people than information, okay? These assemblies are a fundamental step to humanity redeeming itself, humanity restoring itself, because these assemblies, again, it depends on the level of integrity and independence, which I keep saying, but that's why I urge people listening to this to look at ISWE, ISWE, and to look at GLOCAN, because they emerged out of the Global Assembly. And the Global Assembly was a world first for many reasons, but one of them is the integrity of the process. So what that means is that the system by which the learning was created was meticulous. You know, as we've discussed, we had Nigerian oil executives talking about just transition, right? So what happens with these assemblies, if they follow that kind of procedure, you become an island of credible information in an ocean of lies, in an ocean of misinformation. And this is going to become increasingly valuable as we see the rise in the misinformation industry.
I never really like to end a podcast with practicalities, but the last question that I have for you is, if you manage to convince anyone listening to us now to get involved, how can someone get involved? And what is the next Global Assembly going to take place? So if I want to, how can I join?
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thanks everyone for listening and thanks for having me. My organization is oneworldornone.world. And it's an interesting story where that name comes from, but it's to do with Albert Einstein, basically. So you can sign up to oneworldornone.world and join the cultural wave and become part of the effort to bring this into people's lives through popular culture. And then also you need to sign up to ISWE, ISWE. And you also need to follow GLOCAN, GLOCAN. So the next Global Assembly, the idea is to establish a permanent, independent Global Assembly structure to take our world leaders by the hand so that we can make the decisions that they're too frightened to make. So through those organizations, you will be able to support that movement. And I'm Jamie Kelsey Fry on Twitter. It's the only social old men like me, we can just about manage Twitter. That's about it.
So I really like that image of grabbing the politicians by the hand, because you're like turning upside down this image of the politicians giving you a tap in the, you know, in the head, good job, and you're the ones leading the way. I absolutely love that. Jamie, thank you so much. This has been great.
It's a pleasure. You're doing great work, and anything else I can do, just give me a shout. Have a lovely day.
Thank you for staying on that side and listening to my conversation with Jamie Kelsey from the Citizens Global Assembly. Now that we've wrapped up this three-part series on the rise of the far right in Europe, we want to hear from you. You can search for Friends of Europe on LinkedIn and X or send us an email. Our address is press@friendsofeurope.org. As always, don't forget to subscribe to Friends of Europe's podcast wherever you get your podcast to never miss an episode of Policy Voices. I'm Caterina Villanova, and I will be with you again next week. Until then, goodbye.